KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is 9:01. Stay tuned for APA Compass.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian and Pacific American public affairs radio program. Today's program features interviews with a few of the dancers from the Oregon Ballet Theater. Later, we'll hear Sarika's interview with journalist and writer Sandeep Roy. Sarika also had the chance to speak with Grammy-nominated jazz musician Vijay Iyer. First, I had the chance to sit down with Jeff Chang and talk about his new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to APA Compass. I'm Liz Rogers, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Jeff Chang, who currently serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University. Jeff's first book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, won the American Book Award and the Asian American Literary Award, among other accolades. Jeff has written for The Nation, The New York Times, The San Francisco Chronicle, Slate, BuzzFeed, just to name a few. Today we're talking about Jeff's new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Who We Be has been described as an exciting contribution to the history of our present moment, in addition to smashing the assumptions about post-racialism and multiculturalism. Good morning, Jeff, and thanks for sharing some of your time with APA Compass.
Thank you for having me.
Last night, and you had made a statement saying the book Who We Be was much different than you and your publishers thought it was going to be. Can you say a little more about that?
Sure. Well, Who We Be, The Colorization of America is a book that's looking at the last half century of race in the U.S. and doing it through the visual culture. And so I've been interested in the question of, have we achieved racial progress, right? How far have we come? How far have we not come? It's something, of course, that's been on everybody's minds, I think, especially since November 24th, the date that there was a non-indictment in the case of Officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson. The book is kind of even taken on a different kind of life since after its release. But when I first had proposed the book, it was before Barack Obama had decided to run for office. And my publisher was just not interested at that particular point. I said, I want to do something around the rise and fall of multiculturalism. And she was like, nobody cares about that, you know? And then Barack Obama ran for president. And immediately what you started seeing was the rise of this sort of movement that was dedicated towards using race to explicitly try to take away Obama's credibility as a candidate. You had people in Hillary Clinton's camp, Mark Penn, who was the main campaign manager at the time, saying, save it for 2042. We're going to portray Barack Obama as un-American. And that's where it really begins. But then it sort of takes on a new life when we get to the general election, right? And immediately afterwards, when he's elected to office, you start seeing the rise of the birther movement and all these kinds of things. And so the book, which began as sort of this documentation of the rise and the fall of the multiculturalism avant-garde movement, and then the rise again of multiculturalism really in the figure of Obama, right? Ended up becoming an entirely different book once the backlash began to set in. And so the book now, I think, is really about why we can't get past the culture wars around race in the U.S. And why is it that now in our visual culture we've desegregated for all intents and purposes, and yet we still have racial injustice, inequality, cultural inequity rising. All the markers show that we're resegregating at really astonishingly horrifying rates. And so how can that be happening at the same time that we have these images of this sort of happy rainbow country? That was kind of where the book began to move, I think, after 2009.
And I want to go back to sort of the term that you're using, multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
What are we really talking about,
right,
when you use that term?
It's slippery, right? It's a super slippery term. And so what I was hoping to do was to talk about the rise of this avant-garde artistic movement specific to the 1970s. So after the Black Arts Movement, you know, the Asian American arts movement, you know, Chicano, arts movement and that kind of thing that you see is beginning to flourish in the mid-60s to the late-60s and stuff. What you see is in places like Los Angeles and New York, Chicago, Seattle as well, but really in the Bay Area, the rise of these sort of countercultural avant-gardes of people who are really about, like, let's challenge this American notion of assimilation through our art. And so this is where you start seeing artists like Jessica Hagedorn, you know, coming out, or Maxine Hong Kingston, right, or Frank Chin, you know, or Sean Wong, you know, like these are people that you see coming out of the multiculturalism movement, whether or not they call themselves multiculturalists, right, they saw themselves as this avant-garde that was tilting at this sort of large scale myth of the melting pot and of colorblindness. And so this is a moment that's specific, I really think, to the mid-70s. And by the mid-80s, what you see is that a lot of these writers and artists and musicians and that kind of thing have begun to push into the mainstream. And at the same time that this is happening, a whole bunch of students start showing up on the campuses, right? All of these students of color start showing up on the campuses in larger numbers than ever before. And in fact, this projects and provokes a sort of a backlash, especially against Asian Americans at elite universities, right? They start trying to cap admissions. There's a whole debate that begins around affirmative action and around the diversification of the curriculum. And this is when Pat Buchanan declares the culture wars. And he says what's happening is these crazy multiculturalists have, like, begun to tear apart this country, and they're sort of working against our Anglo-American heritage, right? And he declares the culture wars 1992, and the backlash against affirmative action, against ethnic studies, against all of these sort of cultural and policy sort of changes that have come about as a result of the civil rights movement are being turned back. And so by the time you get to the mid-90s, what we see is multiculturalism now in a new form. It's really a corporate multiculturalism, right? And so diversity becomes the catchphrase. It's sort of the catchphrase of the moment, right? And multiculturalism at that point becomes really defanged. I wanted to trace that rise and that fall, like the sort of like initial flowering of this counterculture and then the huge backlash that occurs, so that by the time we get to the new millennium, it's possible for the Republicans to say we're all multiculturalists now. You know, and for George Bush to be appointing Alberto Gonzalez and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, and this is the new multiculturalism, right? So I think what you saw during the 2000s was really, especially I think amongst more radical circles, a backlash against the idea of multiculturalism. When we did that, I felt like we were losing a lot of the history of how this cultural uprising really had provoked these questions in the first place. And so that's what I wanted to recover in the book, as well as to talk about the central role that artists were playing in being able to get us to that point. The artists and those who are in the culture, you know, the thing that they do that politicians can't, that even community organizers can't do, is to project these broad sort of screen images of these alternative worlds that are possible, and to make those kinds of ideas palatable to the public, to the large public. And I think that the artist's struggle is to be able to say, well, like, can you get beyond actually seeing me only for my physiognomy, right? Can you, if I create a painting here, or if I write a book, will it be seen as an Asian American book because of my last name, you know what I mean? Or because of my author picture, right? Or could it be read as the great American novel, or that kind of thing, you know? Right. Or the, whatever, the great American painting, or I don't know, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's the struggle that I think artists of color face, is dealing with that kind of burden of representation. And so if we kind of understand it from that particular point of view, then it looks a little bit different for us.
What do you see as the biggest difference in how we see and talk about race today in contrast to how it was seen and talked about 50 years ago?
Yeah. It's a good question. You know, now clearly you can talk about having racism without racists. This is sort of a really apt phrase coined by Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who's a sociologist, that it's possible to think about how racism continues on without the linked in existence of, say, the White Citizens Council and the City Council, you know what I mean, in different types of jurisdictions. Right. That all we need is for people of goodwill to claim colorblindness, to allow for racism and discrimination and inequality and resegregation to continue. And so when we talk about change, like, we can't get it twisted. It's not the kind of change, quote unquote, that the Sarah Palins or the Pat Buchanans of the world are asking for. That's right. Not change. That's restoration of the status quo. What we're talking about is changing a system that is geared towards, and a national culture that's geared towards, segregation and inequality. I think that's how the conversation has changed. The fact that we can have cultural desegregation that's been made possible by multiculturalism, by hip-hop, that our images could be desegregated, but still be having the system remain the way that it is, mm-hmm. That's, I think, the complex, really difficult problem of our time. And so we're heading towards all of us being minorities, and this is what I was saying last night. In that regard, the big question that we're going to face, that my son and his generation is going to face, is how do we figure out how to form a majority for all minorities. And I'm hopeful that the majority, the new majority that gets created, is dedicated towards racial justice and cultural equity, that we change the culture, that we change the politics, that we change the policies to move in that kind of a direction.
That was Jeff Chang talking about his newest book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. For more information on Jeff and his other publications, you can go to his website at jeffchang.net.
You got space. Everybody's got space.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. Vijay Iyer is a Grammy-nominated jazz musician and winner of the 2013 MacArthur Genius Grant. The music you're listening to is from the Vijay Iyer Trio's latest album, Break Stuff. Something I personally appreciate about Vijay is his social justice engagement. You sometimes might catch him tweeting remarks about hashtag Black Lives Matter, or he challenges us to critically think about what it means to be Asian American and the relationship with Black lives in America. I caught up with Vijay while he was on tour for the Portland Jazz Festival. We met up at the Hotel Monaco downtown, and we talked about these issues. We began our conversation talking about the keynote speech he had given, which was called The Complicity of Excess, and this was given to Yale alumni. The keynote was transcribed and posted on the Asian American Writers Workshop website, and then it went viral.
I mean, it ended up kind of, well, someone who was at the alumni reunion is Ken Chen, who's the director of the Asian American Writers Workshop, which is a wonderful place in New York. They host really interesting readings, and also the website, aaww.org, I think, is really full of brilliant observations and writings by interesting folks. So, and they keep adding new content. It's really exciting to see what they're doing. So he actually, after I gave that speech, he came up to me and said, well, we'd like to publish it. And at first I sort of sat on it for a while. And then finally I just wasn't sure what would happen. I don't know. It's always weird being a person of color in public because lots of things. I don't know. I don't even know how to even begin with that. But I felt that it might create a disturbance in my own sort of path or something, or just might create ripples of some kind. And then finally I said, you know what? Just grow a pair and do it. So that's what I did. I said, fine, okay, yes. Yeah, you should publish it. And I didn't think that I was, part of me was thinking, it's just Asian American Writers Workshop. I mean, no one's going to read this thing. And then it kind of went viral. And now it's basically like the number one article on that site. So that's what I get. Basically what I was saying, you know, this is partly in response to the situation, you know, to be at Yale giving a talk to Asian Americans, it's partly like, what does it mean to gather as Asian Americans? Secondly, what does it mean to do it at Yale? So there were kind of two identities being posited that I found to be sort of a little bit wishful. One was what, you know, the Yale alum as a sort of kind of person, as if we all have something in common because we gave a bunch of money to Yale. and then the second was the idea of an Asian American, or something, you know, like some sort of sense of community that is supposed to emerge through this disparate range of experiences. And so I kind of was asking, basically, in that speech, and asking myself too, because I think about this all the time, and it's been, you know, you could say that my life and as an artist has been about that question: is what is it? What is this us that we're here to celebrate? What does it mean to be Asian American, and particularly to be Yale Asian Americans? What I sort of submitted to everybody is that basically what it means is that we're in. Well, we got here by succeeding, and to succeed in America means that you are basically okay with America, with the idea of America, which is a country that's founded on slavery and genocide. And, you know, that sounds like, well, of course, we all have to live with that every day. And it's, you know, it's something we conveniently forget. But, you know, gathering as people of color in America, like, basically, what is your relationship to anti-blackness? That's partly what I was asking. Are you here because you don't have to deal with that? Because you conveniently are able to forget it? And narratives of success and, like, immigrants who strive and all that, that basically is a way of bypassing the fact of blackness in America, because those people weren't immigrants. You know, they were brought here forcibly and treated as property. So, and then we live in the aftermath of all of that. So I guess I just wanted to submit that as, like, just kind of, I don't know, I was kind of being... a bit of a jerk, because, like, basically I was asked to give some inspiring closing remarks at this gathering, and basically what I wanted to do instead was sort of, like, create some kind of rupture or some sort of, like, break or something, like, what are we even doing here? You know, that kind of thing. So I tried to be nice, but I also was sort of like, you know, we need to rethink this whole enterprise. That was basically my premise.
I don't think it was jerky. I kind of thought it was really ballsy, but, you know, we all have our perspectives.
And, well, I guess, you know, the fact that it went viral in the way that it did suggests that it touched a nerve somehow. I think maybe it's something that people maybe had lurking in the back of their minds but hadn't really thought about how to articulate. And my premise, you know, basically what I said at the end of it was, like, if we're going to talk about an us... we need to be an us who cares about people other than ourselves, you know? And that means particularly fighting for justice for others. And that should be obvious, but it isn't.
Precisely. I guess we should probably talk about your music. Your newest album is called Break Stuff. So tell us about it and how it differs from your other albums.
Well, the album is it's a trio album. I've had this trio for... almost a dozen years with these same gentlemen, Marcus Gilmore on drums and Stefan Crump on bass. And the reason it's called Break Stuff is not because I'm into Limp Bizkit. Somebody finally revealed to me after I had decided on the title that someone had already taken that title. But what I found is that most jazz people don't know that, so that's good. But I'm also, you know, I'm here to reclaim the title for non-Limp Bizkit people in general. It's called Break Stuff because it's stuff that happens in the breaks. It's sort of, I'm interested in how things grow when we don't expect or force them to. And that's sort of how this trio has evolved over the years. It started as part of a quartet that we had had for some years, and sometimes we would do trio pieces in the breaks in the quartet set. Okay. And then we had the opportunity to tour in Europe as a trio, and then we were offered a record deal while we were in Europe. It was pretty surprising, and as a trio, and it wasn't even, it was, to me, it was sort of like, this is just a sort of provisional thing I'm doing right now. So it wasn't that, I mean, it kind of became plan A. It was originally sort of like, let me do this for a while I figure out what to do next. And then it became the thing that I was doing, you know. that we were doing together, and it really just evolved in a very natural way, just by being patient and listening to each other. And you know, I would write material, and we'd also take on other material, including maybe most famously Galang by MIA and Human Nature, Michael Jackson song, a couple other things. So we've made a few albums in this configuration, and this is the third. This time I felt confident about really making it about our music, original music. But a lot of the music that we did on this album is adapted from other projects, and so it all has this sense of like reduction or repurposing or kind of doing something it's not supposed to do. And when we do that, it sort of just takes us outside of ourselves, and that's kind of part of the process for me, a process of transformation and growth. So I like this album, and I hope you do too.
I talk to a lot of artists of color, get frustrated about being kind of forced into a niche audience or labeled, and it's very hard to become mainstream. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're trying to be loyal. Do you ever have any experiences like this? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the thing is that music works in ways that sometimes people don't realize. You know, niches are that's the work of the the marketplace. It's sort of a way of selling you or preventing you from being sold so that someone else can sell something else instead of you. Pigeonholing is a way of sort of like reducing what people do to styles or labels or categories or isms, you know. But music is much more of an open process than that. I've just sort of come to realize this from doing it, you know, that it does its own kind of work of reaching people. And I don't mean critics, I mean people. And I don't mean musicians either. I mean regular people. The way that music can kind of put an experience in your body and give you a shared collective experience with others, that it creates a sort of bond. That does its own work that words cannot even reach, you know. And so I have come to just trust and believe in that process above all, and that's why I keep making music. Not because I'm trying to combat what some dumb blogger said somewhere, or, you know, I mean, this album came out last week, and I've been a bit frustrated because 100% of the reviews have been written by white men. 100. I mean, like, all of them. I'm talking about a few dozen, you know? Like, it's kind of... And it becomes fatiguing after a while because they all say the same stuff. All the reviews are kind of laced with microaggressions. You know, it's kind of like, oh, well, like they are always saying that I make mathematical music. Oh. That's an example. You know, I mentioned that in that speech, actually. Mm-hmm. These sort of like model minority logic that frames the way some of these critics will respond. And it's partly because, for one thing, in jazz at least, it's white men who do all the talking, and they do make all the decisions about who should play where, who gets what record deal, who gets written about in what magazine, right? So it's they who are starting from this set of assumptions about you, about what you should and should not be doing, or what kind of freedom you should be. Men who do all the talking. Starting from this set of assumptions about you, about what you should and should not be doing, or what kind of freedom you should be afforded or should be revoked from you, you know. So it's, you know, they're not able to actually hear what's happening with a sort of open heart. And so that's what I mean by it, you know, music bypasses all that when it's actually made for and with and among people. So that's kind of the process that I stake my life on.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you so much, Vijay, for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
That was Grammy-nominated jazz musician Vijay Iyer of the Vijay Iyer Trio. The music you hear is from their latest album, Break Stuff. You can learn more at vijay-iyer.com. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening. Thanks again for listening to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. Sandeep Roy is a journalist and writer with a past as a computer scientist. He's the host and producer of KALW San Francisco's Dispatches from Kolkata, a weekly story about life in changing India. And Sandeep is perfect for telling these stories. He was born and brought up in Kolkata, then spent 20 years in San Francisco, where he found his voice as a journalist. About 4 years ago, he moved back to Kolkata and recently published his debut novel, Don't Let Him Know. Sandeep joined me by phone while he was in California for his Bay Area book tour. We talked about the book's fascinating characters, LGBTQ issues in India, and what it means to join the ranks of South Asian American writers. Something else I really liked about the novel is kind of what you were talking about. It's about these family secrets. Sometimes these are potentially devastating, and sometimes seemingly innocuous acts of rebellion, kind of depending on the reader and the character. I loved the last chapter so much, and I don't really know how to ask you to talk about it without giving away too much to the readers and to the listeners, but give it a try.
I'll try, but you know, the chapter, the story, in a way, it begins in California when the son of Mitha discovers a fragment of a letter that he thinks contains a secret about his mother and what he thinks it's a letter from a past lover. But he doesn't realize that the secret actually carries embedded within it another secret. And
right.
His mother, when she herself was a newly arrived immigrant to America, to a small town, Carbondale in Illinois, which was actually my point of entry into the U.S. as well, she received this letter, and she thought she had hidden it for many decades until inadvertently the son finds it and thinks he has found a great secret about his mother, not knowing that the secret carries within it another secret as well. And then years later, and then this is in the last chapter, and we follow the families back and forth. We learn more about the secrets and their backstories. But at the end, and the last chapter is called The Scene of the Crime, and Amit, the son, decides to take his mother back on sort of a nostalgia tour of Carbondale, where she had once arrived. And, in that chapter, I would say in some ways, his mother, Romola, who is, you know, now widowed and doesn't have particularly pleasant memories of her time in Carbondale, but it sort of goes along, because the son wants her to go. You know, she finally finds a rather unexpected release in that chapter from the weight of the secret that she's been carrying around, for decades.
That was an excellent synopsis without giving away any spoilers.
and let me just say, for effect, it involves a little bit of vampy Bollywood numbers from Asha Bhosle, and it has a little bit of gin and tonic in it as well. There you go.
Yes, there was also that. It's a great chapter.
I thought at that point that the character of Romola, who goes through quite a bit in that book, that she deserved to have a gin and tonic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was an incredible release and an incredible story of different characters coming together. It's a really amazing novel. A unique element in that I don't think it's talked about much. You know, Avinash is exploring these gay chat rooms and clubs at an older period in his life and talking about these characters coming together. It felt like he's finding this community through the power of the internet and this, you know, finding community through anonymity. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I wanted to really address that in the character of Avinash, who is, and, you know, it's not much of a spoiler to say, is a man not unlike many thousands of other men in India who might, you know, in other ways identify as gay, but ended up getting married to women because of social pressures, family pressures, or just simply because they couldn't imagine what a life as a gay man would entail in a country like India at that time. And Avinash is one such character, and I wanted very much not to make him sort of the villain of the piece, even if he has lied in a certain sense. But I wanted to make him, you know, even though he's done that, he's still a good husband and a good father and a decent father in to the best of his ability. But at one point, you know, but I can imagine that somebody like Avinash is growing up at a time where there's very few resources to find other people like him. Everything has to be stuff he's just stumbled upon accidentally. There's no internet, there are no chat rooms, there are no gay organizations, there's no pride parade, there's no gay bar.
You know, there's really no support.
Resources exist at that time. And then later on, I mean, in India, that's scene has changed radically because partly of the advent of the internet and partly because of many activists who worked on the ground. And so somebody sitting in a remote corner of India can actually connect to other gay people around the country, whether it's through chat rooms or organizations or whatever. But the internet especially has been a huge motivating factor. And now there are gay parties and events in most cities in India that happen regularly. And I wanted to imagine what it would be like for a character like Avinash to go to one of these events and, you know, sort of walk into this little wonderland filled with strobe lights and the latest Bollywood music and see all these maybe hundreds of gay men having a good time, laughing, enjoying the evening with each other, dancing. And it must be kind of a poignant, bittersweet moment for him to realize that even, you know, that this has happened within his lifetime, that he's able to witness this sort of transformation within the LGBT scene in India. And yet, at some level, he must feel even more poignantly that it's come a little too late for him. And, you know, he must be standing there wishing he was that all this had been available to him when he was 25 or something like that. And I wanted to, and that's a sort of generational thing that is happening in India right now. And I wanted to have a little glimpse of that in the book.
That's true. That's a good point. And speaking of which, well, I wanted to understand a timeline. I know that you lived in the US for 20 years. And when did you move back to India?
I moved to India in about 4 years ago.
About 4 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, in 2011.
So because a lot of your journalistic work is giving dispatches from India, including coverage on gay rights issues and the culture of the community and the culture of gay rights in India. And with this theme in your novel, with a storyline in your novel about an almost gay couple or a forbidden love or something, you know, something to that effect, I was curious, how was your book received in India, especially in light of the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, the Supreme Court decision that sort of recriminalized homosexual sex was kind of a setback. But at the same time, I would say that in many ways, this whole issue is like toothpaste out of the tube. Because for about 4 years, there was a there was a Delhi High Court verdict which had decriminalized homosexuality, a lot of stuff had just literally come out of the closet. You know, there was much more visibility around gay issues and gay people in the media than ever before. And what was striking about the Supreme Court decision was actually that when it happened, the almost near total, especially in the English language media, near total condemnation of that decision, that even though the Supreme Court said it was about a minuscule minority, you wouldn't have felt that if you read the op-ed pages of all the major newspapers in India, which definitely condemned this decision in no uncertain terms, because I think it went against a sort of image that India was cultivating for itself as kind of a modern democratic, you know, liberal democracy. And so in that sense, the book, I mean, you know, it was not a book that originated in the US and then went to India. It's a book that was actually originated in India and then went to UK and US and other places in the world. So in that sense, it was publishers in India who saw the potential in the story and actually embraced it rather than balking at the content. And in a certain sense, the dialogue has moved so far ahead that this issue itself, you know, doesn't really phase people at all. And the reviews that have come out, I mean, the book has only been out in India for about a month as of now, but the reviews that have come out in papers like the Indian Express or the Hindustan Times or Scroll or Open Magazine have all been very positive, and none of them have in the least bit been bothered by the gay angle in it.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I think I do remember reading about the English language newspapers condemning the Supreme Court overturning decision. So it's good. It's just, hopefully we'll see more progress within our lifetimes, you know?
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, speaking of storytelling, as a South Asian American, I didn't discover any books where I could relate to experiences personally until I was well into college. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just thrilled, you know, all these years later, I'm thrilled to see this cadre of writers such as yourself, Chitra Banerjee, Jhumpa Lahiri, recently published Naomi Muravira. I personally like to think of it as like a revolution of writers. So I was curious how you, as a writer in this group, how do you feel as being a part of this, what I am coining a revolution, or do you feel that there's too much pressure to represent the community? Have I put you in a tough spot here?
No, in fact, I've been thinking about that. And actually, I think, okay, let me say this is a double-edged sword in some ways. And let me explain why. Because at one level, another writer, a South Asian American writer coming up with a work of fiction, is going to be met with a certain amount of pushback from publishers who feel that, oh, there are already all these other voices out there. You know, so they might come to that person and say, oh, you've written about Bengali immigrants coming to America, but you know, Jhumpa Lahiri has already written wonderfully about them. Though nobody will ever say to, say, an Anglo-American writer that, oh, you've written about suburbanites in New Jersey, but, you know, John Updike already wrote the Rabbit trilogy long time ago, and so we don't need any more suburban novels. But so there is that little bit of pressure that you have to work against. But on the other hand, the liberating thing about it is that because there are so many voices out there, it in fact frees you from a lot of that burden of representation that you're talking about, because you feel like you're not the only one out there, and so therefore the reputation and prestige and pride of 1 billion South Asian people, it does not rest on your shoulders alone, that, you know, that your character is not going to become the archetype of all, whatever, Indian immigrants or all Indian gay men or all anything. And you can just concentrate on telling the stories. And I think that is actually a wonderfully liberating thing. So, you know, I can, but it's also wonderful to meet some of these other South Asian writers like Naomi, who is a new and good friend, and you know, and we can moan and complain and drink wine together and share horror stories about book tours and publicity and this and that, and it's great to see all these other voices out there and to feel that this is becoming kind of an accepted canon in American literature.
Good, good. Well, Sandeep Roy, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be an APA Compass.
That was journalist and writer Sandeep Roy joining me by phone from San Francisco. His debut novel is called Don't Let Him Know. You can catch his dispatches from Kolkata Weekly on KALW. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
Say what you like. Say what you will. I got everything I need. Right here. There ain't nothing they can tell.
The Oregon Ballet Theater, right here in Portland, has a surprisingly diverse company of dancers. I had the opportunity to chat with three Asian dancers back in December for another KABU program, Stage and Studio. Principal dancer Xuan Cheng, soloist Ye Li, and company dancer Gohei Guana joined me in studio. You've probably seen beautiful billboards of Xuan Cheng as Cinderella all over town last month when she was cast in the lead role. When I met these three dancers, they were promoting the Nutcracker for the holiday season, and I had to ask their thoughts on the portrayal of the Chinese tea ceremony dance.
I have one question about the Nutcracker performance. That is, there is a scene, the Chinese tea dance. So again, in this country, traditionally, ballet was not very diverse, and so it would usually be white dancers in the makeup and the costumes who are doing this dance. So I'm curious how this will function for the Oregon Ballet Theater.
It's just a character.
Yeah.
It's nothing really...
Yeah, I mean, from, I guess, the 60s. I asked one of the... choreographer, I said, because in Chinese you always doing something like everybody's fingers like this. So I asked the choreographers like, why we do that? I'm Chinese, but I never do that. And he tell me, he says, oh, I think that means chopsticks.
Chopsticks?
Uh-huh. Holding chopsticks, right?
I say, that's weird, but you... I don't know. I mean, just basically, I figured out at the beginning. I try to understand why it's like that, because we're not like that. At the end, I can't really figure out what is it, but just be it. That's a character. That's your job, and you're supposed to be there. You know?
So, do you all have to follow that choreography?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you all do it. Yeah.
So, in this production, you're all going to be playing characters in the Chinese tea dance, I assume, or?
Yes, yeah. Me and Ye will be performing Chinese.
Yeah.
Some part, for example, like as you said, like we are talking about a Chinese dance, but there is a section we will dance Spanish dance. Spanish will be like more passions, mm-hmm. and like, you know, like salsa, tango, kind of those kind of. Image, not like dancing stuff, more like passion, like, I don't know, dancing more sharp or anything like that. And also the, like, talking about the last topic was like, for me, it's like, it's just who's the choreographer made a Nutcracker. There's a lot of character, we just follow. And it's sometimes really funny to see what choreography you think. Like, for example, okay, for the Nutcracker, the second act, I want to invite, you know, a lot of countries, people to celebrate, for example. Then, okay, for example, Spanish, what do you emerge in? Like, more longer dress, not like tutu, and red lipstick, and...
and the men, they draw, you know, like they have mustache and...
Yeah, more costume, it's like more Spanish costume, you know. It's like seams, and costumes and the dance style eat much. And sometimes to, like, for example, like Chinese dance or Arabian dance, it's just the, I guess, like first impact of the imagination of those countries. For example, like what the Ye was saying, the Chinese tea and, you know, maybe like if you think about Asia, what they have in Asia, oh, tea, they have a good tea, you know.
That was Xuan Cheng, Ye Li, and Kohei Kuana, all dancers with the Oregon Ballet Theater, who joined me in studio back in December. This was a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Stage and Studio. To hear the entire interview, visit our website at www.apacompass.wordpress.com. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
In preparation for APA Compass's 10th anniversary next month, we've been digging into our archives. Up next is a piece that was featured way back in 2006 when Collective members Pam Fon and Jay Sablon took a stroll down Hawthorne to talk to some vendors about their Asian and Asian-themed products.
As a merchant here on Hawthorne, what draws your interest into like Asian-style furniture items to sell in the store?
It's such a classic style that it maintains throughout trends. Like something with a more retro theme may be out next season, however the Asian theme has maintained for such a long time, and it's such a classic and diverse at the same time design, and there's so much you can do, and there's so many sects of the Asian cultures that have their own beautiful artwork, that it kind of incorporates itself into style and homes. And I have an Asian-themed bedroom, watercolor paintings, I have lotus flowers, I have a Chinese screen.
Well, I like the Japanese like looks, where it's very sleek and stylish. I think it's pretty cool. Like, I mean, I like the looks. I was born here, raised here, so it's kind of foreign to me, too. I'm Chinese.
Well, personally, my house, I like decorating with things of different cultures, whether it's because I admire what it looks like or I'm interested in studying other cultures or the respect for other cultures. And I think having, what, let's say, whatever it be, whether it's furniture, clothing, textiles, whatever, art, from any culture is significant, but I also think it's important to maintain culture. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot, I just don't like the way the world's been westernized.
It seems like our Thai Buddhas are very popular images that we have. We have very large sculptural pieces, and they're gold-leafed. A lot of people buy those for their own altars or like a garden space.
You know, I hadn't thought about it before, but a lot of the Asian, like the Asian cards are really popular, and like I'm thinking about Me So Pretty. I never thought about it before.
Oh, there's a product called Me So Pretty?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
It's our best-selling bath and body product.
Does it have miso in it?
No, it's got bamboo and lemongrass in it, though. Pomegranate. Yeah, it's just the line name, but it's our best-selling line because people see the packaging, which is very bright, very like Japanese cartoony in some aspects of it. And it's just their culture is so, has influenced the art so much that people love it.
We like to feature like really spectacular oddities here, things that people aren't going to find anywhere else in the States. Last summer we had a Shiva statue, which is Hindu, and it was over 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. The other day a woman came in and she wanted to buy a present for her acupuncturist and wanted it for this woman's office, but she didn't want to like have a really strong message behind this piece, more general and soothing, and so we were recommending like maybe a Buddha or a Kuan Yin because of what they represent and how like all-encompassing they are, and like a goddess of compassion and working in, you know, acupuncture, and we felt like that was a good suggestion, and she went with that.
I mean, how many people are actually aware of what it is they're purchasing? Which is okay if you buy something just because what it looks like. But I think if you are going to decorate your house with things, say, from I was raised Catholic, and I'm not Catholic, but I flirted with Buddhism and Catholicism and other things. I have different deities all over my home, and I feel that I should be educated about what they are. So if someone from set culture comes over and asks me a question about a particular piece in my house, I should know a little bit more about it than, well, I liked how it looked.
We live in Indonesia. Yeah, my wife's Javanese. Right? So, yeah, we actually work with real people, families, our neighbors, and we put money into the hands of the people who actually do the work.
So yeah. What's the percentage of, in terms of profit for the artisans, percentage of profit that they receive?
Okay, what we do is we pay for the labor. Okay. So we're not getting the items, selling them, and then coming back.
Okay.
What we're doing is we're basing our pay level on 20 to 25% above what they would get if they were either working at a factory or doing some other similar job. Over half the products that I have are probably products that you could just as easily lay on the beach and drink your Mai Tais and order from a middleman at the same price or cheaper, because the workers are not making enough money.
Which are your favorite items in the store and why?
And why? Yoshitomo Nara, Japanese artist, we've carried for a bit of time, and he's very, very popular. We try to carry as much of his, I guess, retail stuff as we can. We have T-shirts that are designed by him, his art pieces, and then he came out with journals and calendars and postcard sets and stuff, and those just do great. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is kind of like the newer version of pop culture, just images. I mean, sushi on Band-Aids. I mean, who would have thought, you know?
APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. Thanks to today's guests, Jeff Chang, Vijay Iyer, Sandeep Roy, and our friends at the Oregon Ballet Theater, Xuan Chang, Ye Li, and Kohei Kuana. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m., the first Friday of every month, and is produced by Liz Rogers and myself, Sarika Mehta. You can listen to a podcast of this episode at apacompass.wordpress.com. Hey, APA Compass is getting a new name and a new look starting July. We'll be called Intersections, produced by Liz Rogers and myself, Sarika Mehta. We'll still broadcast the first Fridays at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is APA Compass on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up next, stay tuned for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints. Tests, cheating, and educational corruption. Bob Schaefer of Fair Test says that the Atlanta cheating scandal is only the tip of the iceberg. Presidential candidate Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin denies his responsibility to safeguard health care for more than 180,000 Wisconsin residents. At 11 on the Radio Zine, we hear a panel from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference on this recent Supreme Court of Canada's decision in the Socotine Nation versus British Columbia decision, which empowered First Nations people seeking to assert title over their traditional territories. Thanks, KBOO members, for your continued support. If you're not a member, you can remedy that right now at kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today. Keep it locked right here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, March 3rd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio.